Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Our theme today, what is one of the most important stories that has not been told yet concerning COVID? And yet this is not specifically about COVID. I will not be asking my guest to talk about the failed PCR test or the overinflation of the mortality statistics, including people who died in auto accidents as having died from COVID. The amount of medications that could have been used early on, safe and FDA approved, that were not allowed to be used, and medications that were proven to stop the virus were denigrated and attacked by the New England Journal of Medicine, the Lancet, and the British, and the Journal of the American Medical Association. The enormous profits made off this, the absolute stranglehold of control in science by a small group of people where science is supposed to be open and flexible with dynamic energy and civil conversation and debate. None of that was allowed, where the media was rubber stamping every single thing. None of that is going to be asked today. Instead, we're going to be asking a far more important question. And I'll tell you that in a moment. But first, my guest. Her name is Leslie Manoukian, M-A-N-O-O-K-I-A-N. She is the founding president of the Health Freedom Defense Fund, which is a nonprofit organization committed to the education, protection, and advancement of health freedom while advocating for human rights and bodily autonomy of all people. The fund opposes unethical laws such as vaccine mandates for all people. Earlier, Leslie was a very successful Wall Street business executive. Her career in finance took her from New York to London with Goldman Sachs. Later, she was the director of Alliance Capital in London, running their European growth portfolio management and research business. While working in global finance, she also continued her education in homeopathy. In 2011, she wrote and produced an award-winning documentary called The Greater Good that explores the vaccine debate and controversies. She received her undergraduate degrees from Middlebury College and later her MBA from the University of Chicago. Leslie's organization's website is healthfreedomdefense.org. Nice to have you with us today, Leslie.
It's my honor to be with you, Gary, after so many years. It's really great. Thank you.
There are several issues that I have not seen that people have taken on, possibly because they were not aware of them, because it takes a special education and background to understand why these issues are important. And we're going to start right at the top. There's a financial reason behind the crisis that has not been discussed openly and honestly. Would you begin by having that discussion with us and what we should know that up to this point we do not know?
Sure. It's very interesting issue to even start contemplating. And I think that, you know, so many of the people who've been involved with the pushback against COVID for the last 2 years have been saying, this doesn't make any sense. This doesn't make any sense. I don't understand. And when you start to consider this piece of the puzzle, it all starts to make sense. At least that's my perspective. So what most people don't understand is that for the last essentially 15 years, maybe 17 years or so, really since the Great Recession in 2008-09, central banks in the United States, the Fed, and in Europe, the European Central Bank, or ECB, have been propping up the financial system of those countries. And the reason that they're doing that is a variety of things. Obviously, we got to this point where they said, banks are too big to fail, insurance companies are too big to fail. But there's a much, much bigger component of this. And it's a far more, I think, insidious one as well. And that is that governments, our governments, have screwed up massively. They have been borrowing with no intention of ever repaying that debt. And this is why they keep raising the debt ceiling. This is why they keep just kicking the debt can down the street. And it's because they really don't ever want to have to pay the piper. You know, they're never going to have this come full circle as long as they can avoid it. And what's happened is, so they have no intention of ever repaying the debt. They keep promising to the public in order to get elected that they're going to get greater and greater benefits. And their very policies, the government's very policies, are actually undermining the integrity of our financial institution. And so what's happening is we're in this situation where the banks in Europe are bankrupt, the commercial banks. In the US, they're okay because the Fed made them write off all of their bad debt over the last 10, 12 years. But in Europe, that's not the case. They are still carrying all the bad debt, or a huge portion of it that they were carrying in 2008-09. They never wrote it off, and they never wrote it off for political reasons, which I can get into if you'd like. But basically, you've got a situation where the banks in Europe are broke. The United States has borrowed. We've gone from $1 trillion in the 1980s in debt to now $30 trillion in national debt. That'll never be repaid. It's just not possible. And we've got a $5 trillion unfunded pension, public pension liability. That was as of the end of 2018. In Europe, those numbers are reversed in that their national debts aren't quite as high, but their public pension liability that is unfunded is gigantic. It's $50 trillion, roughly, in Europe. And if you add the UK into that, it's almost $60 trillion. So we are talking about debt obligations of such proportions that they will never be able to get themselves out of this. And the problem is that this has actually been perpetuated, in fact, created by their own policies, which I can go into. But basically, that's the backdrop. So the pensions are huge. They're broke. The government debt is huge. We won't be able to repay it. And the pensions are just one aspect of that. And they can't keep kicking the debt can down the street. But that's the kind of gist of it, Gary.
Let me put that in a little different perspective based upon what you just said, to see if I'm understanding you correctly. After all, this is an area you have a lot of experience because you work with Goldman Sachs. You were in Wall Street. You were in the belly of the beast. So if I'm hearing you correctly, there are really two narratives underway that both parallel and also intersect each other. One, we all know, and I mentioned at the beginning of the program, that is the medical establishment's response to the COVID pandemic. That is the propaganda narrative promoting junk science, false information, as a rationale to impose vaccine mandates and masks and social isolation, in effect, a new caste system, like a vaccine apartheid between the vaccinated and the unvaccinated, and creating a medical security state to ban and censor medical professionals and citizens who criticize this narrative. They actually have that in Canada now, under Trudeau. You mention anything about COVID or the vaccines, and you can be arrested. Then there's another narrative that is far more subtle and yet clearly transparent and out in the open. And that is, there is an enormous effort underway to completely overhaul our socio-financial system and dramatically revision the means of political governance and control over national populations. And this will be technologically driven and based on a model where humans are nothing more than data or information to be modified for a completely new kind of postmodern capitalism that doesn't really have a name yet to define it. It's an entirely new beast. So, of course, this is the Great Reset and now the great narrative that recently came out of the World Economic Forums earlier this year. So, this much I understand. However, what is being ignored is a complete overhaul of the neo-capitalism system, or our social infrastructure, our domestic political governance, and a new paradigm of international collaboration, which is crucial as the World Economic Forum and so many other leaders of developed nations, such as the United States, Germany, United Kingdom, and Canada, and others would claim. And evidently, our current system is a complete failure, imposes untold dangers and risks. Otherwise, why overhaul and replace it with this Build Back Better program and paradigm? And I would add one more thing. There is an interrelationship, let's even say a co interdependency between these two narratives, the medical and pandemic narrative, and then the Great Reset and socioeconomic narrative. And we see this clearly when Klaus Schwab proclaims that the COVID pandemic presents a unique opportunity to radically transform global society and our financial system. So I would argue the pandemic and the Great Reset are each piggybacking off each other, yet both have a singular goal and mission. So this leads into what you're discussing more in depth, and there is a financial reason behind the health crisis and almost nonsensical unscientific measures and policies being instituted to deal with the pandemic. So when I look at the debt that you're talking about, $60 trillion, that can never be paid back. That's more than the gross domestic product of all of Europe. So then that's looking at the American debt, and most people hear the debt of $30 trillion. But that's inaccurate, because I've done the research and I found that when you add in other government pension plans, unfunded, entitlements underfunded or unfunded, our entire social credit system and digital currencies then would be based upon a promise. Car debt, student debt, household debt, mortgages, all the debt that we incur, when you add it all up, it's $222 trillion. That does not include derivatives. So combining and harmonizing with what you just said, and I'm looking at something that would be impossible for any country in the world throughout its entire existence to repay, $222 trillion. To put that in perspective, in 2008 and 9, when some countries in the world, such as Greece and Ireland and Spain, were called completely financially irresponsible because their debt to the gross domestic product, income, total income versus their liabilities, was somewhere between 120 to 180%. And Goldman Sachs then actually exploited that, as you know, to their advantage in Greece, even causing 50% of their pensions to be taken away. And therefore, people literally were at debt's door and frequently lost their homes, et cetera, who had worked their whole life, honorably so. So now, I did the math, and it's 1,100% debt to gross domestic product in the United States. That means we are literally the most indebted nation in world history, and yet we call ourselves prosperous, and some are, but the rest of the country isn't. So when I look at how far in debt we are, and I look at how far in debt you have told us Great Britain and the European Union, its 27 nation states, are, you're looking at over $300 trillion, just those countries.
And Gary, so, just to be clear, I'm just choosing one thing, right? Which is what government is most responsible for. And what's really important to understand is that the reason that the pensions are broke is because of government policy. The central banks have had negative interest rates or zero interest rates, and that's the real issue. So
I want you to go into that in depth. I just want to give one final caveat, that then what makes sense, and I'm merely speculating, is that the reason that we have had all these world leaders in over 190 countries all agreeing, using the same exact language, build back better, you own nothing and you'll be happy, is because I believe, I can be completely wrong, that they intend to cancel all debt and therefore go to a social credit and digital currencies where they control it. They will be the stakeholders. We will own nothing. They will own everything, and they'll have complete control over every aspect of our lives. Am I on the right track or not? Did I understand what you were saying, or am I off?
100%. So essentially, to kind of cap it off, what they're doing is they are installing a digital control grid. Okay. And the reason that they're doing that is because they have been profligate with their spending. They have been reckless with their policies. They've undermined our system. We don't have capitalism. We have, at the best, crony capitalism, at the worst, fascism or an oligarchy, right? This is not capitalism that we see in play. And what's happening is that those who are in power, who have promulgated all of these horrendous policies, don't want to lose power, and they can see the writing on the wall. So what happened in 2019 was a harbinger of what was coming. And I don't know if you'll remember this, but in September or October of 2019, there was a financial crisis and repo market rates spiked to 10% overnight. So think about that. You take a loan out right now, you take a 30-year loan out and you could probably get it for 4 or 5%, maybe even lower, depending on the size of the loan. To borrow money for overnight was 10%. And the reason for that was because the US banks didn't want the counterparty risk of dealing with the European banks. And what happens is banks come together in something called the overnight window. And the Fed backs that up. The overnight window is a way that they can, let's just say one bank gets paid off a $250 million loan and they don't want that sitting on their balance sheet overnight. They'll loan it through the overnight window to another bank. And they loan it at almost 0%. So it's a risk-free rate. Well, that rate spiked to 10% for overnight money. And what happened was the Fed realized that we were in dire straits. And it was because of what you mentioned about the derivatives. There are more than $600 trillion of derivatives extant in the world today, which is just a ginormous number that's really hard to even comprehend. And if just one of those fails, or if one country defaults, the whole system comes down. And so I believe what happened was in 2019, it became so dramatically clear to the Fed that they had to do something. And what they did was they used COVID as the cover, because they have to do something in order to retain control and to buy off the populace when they reset the system. And they want to do that before the system collapses, right? And so what's going to happen is that, you know, hundreds of millions of people who've been told that they have these pensions in place that they've been paying into for decades, they're going to be gone. And what happens when all those people wake up one day, their pensions aren't there, and they realize that the politicians in power are responsible for that? History teaches us that there will be hell to pay, right? And so I believe what's happening is they will attempt a debt holiday, like you're suggesting, and that they will get rid of everybody's debt in order to conceal the fact that they have to default on their debt. And this is why for the last 5 years or so, maybe even more, there have been universal basic income or guaranteed basic income programs being trialed all over the world, especially in Europe and in the United States, in Canada, in California. And so this is simultaneously destigmatizing being on the dole, as well as accepting that government is in control of how much you earn. So it started out as these pilot programs where they give people $500 to $1,000 a month, which isn't dramatically far off from all of the COVID relief money that was given, is it? And what will ultimately happen is, as I mentioned, there's this digital control grid that they want to implement. And so you've mentioned it as well, obviously, the vaccine passports, the voter ID, driver's license, healthcare, insurance, authorization to work, banking, financial, travel, everything, right? Anything and everything will be on that one consolidated digital identification, including access to the internet. And absent that, you won't be able to participate in life. And so what I believe will happen is that they will cancel their own debt, but not until they've got these universal basic income programs fully in place, so that when they default on the pensions, they can say, don't worry, folks, it's all okay, you're going to get UBI instead. And so that's how they will placate the masses. And what they will do is they will say, but in exchange for that, you have to give us your assets. So they will cancel all the debt of the populace in exchange for taking all their assets, so you will own nothing, but you'll be happy because you'll get UBI. And under this whole framework, this plan, they will be able to then collapse their own debt after they've already lined their pockets with the debt, the $30 trillion and plus. I mean, you know, my friend Catherine Austin Fitz talks about I forget what number she thinks it is now that's been stolen. It's at least $20 trillion from Americans. The point is that all of this money has lined their pockets. They've bought assets, which they will be able to retain. And the average peeps won't be able to have anything, because in order to be able to move, go to a concert, engage in society, do anything, they'll have to get the digital identification card that is authorized by the government. And absent that, they won't be able to pay for themselves. And this is why so many of the policies that we've heard in the last 2 years make no sense. Like, so I can go to Walmart and that's safe, but I can't go to my local grocery store or to a, you know, a natural health food store or a small business, right? These things don't make any sense because they want to get rid of the small and medium-sized businesses. Small and medium-sized businesses employ roughly 2/3 of our workforce, and you can't get everybody onto UBI if they're independent. And so this is how I think it's all going to work, is that they will use all of the installation of these checkpoints all over our economy and all over society. That was the whole reason for COVID, to get the passports in place and the digital checkpoints. And then they will take the next step, whatever that will mean. There's also a war on cash, which I can go into and talk about that, because that's a critical component of this. Central bank digital currencies and all of this stuff. But I completely agree with you that this is about collapsing everything so that the people who are in power retain power. And the only way that that happens is through implementation of a security state, biosecurity state, very similar to the social credit score that they've already got in China.
I appreciate your overview. Thank you. Yes, I do want to go into a cashless society. I also want to go into how much will the average person accept, especially after all the lies and deception about COVID, before they finally are out of their comfort zone. Because the reason that you do not see average Americans in the streets protesting anything is because it's not that there's nothing to protest. There's a great deal to protest, but they're still in their comfort zone. It's only when something specific, for example, the school teachers did not protest anything at all until it was their turn. Mandatory vaccination for the teachers or they lose their job. Suddenly, they found their voice. Suddenly, they got out of the classroom and got on the street and joined the others. But that is a self-absorbed and selfish reason to do something, because it impacts you and only you, no matter how you wrap it. Those who said, my body, my choice, okay, that's good. Well, what about now that it's the government's body, not yours, and you can be penalized? In fact, in Austria, they were put into detention centers. Not a myth, not a conspiracy theory. They actually had film of people going from home. They were negative. They tested negative 3 times, but they didn't want the vaccine. So they took them. The police took the woman, and this one I saw, took her to this detention center, and it was a whole imprisonment camp. And she had a tiny little room, and when she walked out the door, there was a line on the floor. If she dared step over that line, she would be arrested. She would be fined up to $3,000, and she'd have to spend more time there. Mind you, this is a woman who tested that she was not positive by their test 3 times. That was irrelevant. And then think of the people who lost their jobs, lost their income. It doesn't seem that any government really cared. So at what point do we begin to understand that nobody seems to be caring? We just see these monolithic, metastasizing structures of bureaucracies and technocrats running them that dictate what freedom I have. You mean I have the freedom to vote for you or not to vote for you, but I do not have the freedom to decide what kind of experimental DNA or RNA goes into my body. So I don't have that freedom? No, you don't have that freedom. Do I have a freedom of speech? Only if we decide your speech is not in any way challenging our power. But wasn't the First Amendment put in place not to support people's good speech, but speech that would be considered unacceptable? And the answer is yes. So anything unacceptable now, we're no longer allowed to engage in. And then Obama, on New Year's Eve, Christmas Eve, passed the National Defense Authorization Act, which removes habeas corpus. And you could be detained indefinitely. So now these people are very happy to get the pro-vaccinated people to condemn the unvaccinated people, and then to say that you are a threat to the rest of society, you're irresponsible, you're dangerous. Even one host on CNN actually opined that if an unvaccinated person had a medical emergency of any kind, had to go to the hospital, they shouldn't get that treatment. After all, let them get their karma. Are you saying if someone has a heart attack or stroke, Are you saying that the 165 million Americans who have autoimmune conditions and therefore shouldn't be getting a vaccine that will overstimulate their immune system? And anyone who knows basic physiology, basic biochemistry, and basic immunology knows that you cannot constantly overstimulate an immune system. So if you're vaccinated and every time you get a booster, you're overstimulating. But that's okay, even though it's not based upon science. But if you say, I've already got COVID, I'm naturally immunized and better immunized, at least 2 years and possibly for life, and I'm less likely to spread this to anyone else, where in Great Britain, just last week, the official figures came out showing that 91% of the people dying in hospital were the fully vaccinated, and that over 88% of the people going to hospitals were the fully vaccinated. So we were told just the opposite. Well, the media could find that out also. If I can find out from an official record, they could. So we're now seeing that every piece of this puzzle that we all thought previously had one knot interlocking with the other, it's all an interdynamic relationship headed by people who are using COVID conveniently as the excuse to reset society. But I want you to focus in a moment on one thing. So if you would, Leslie, please continue by showing us in the United States, even though we're worldwide, shown all over the world, what is the likely outcome to people who thought they had a pension, maybe they have a pension and Social Security, maybe they just have a pension or just Social Security, but almost all their expenses and what they're going to do for the rest of their life is based upon what they can afford to do. And most people live within their means. Most people are rather responsible, especially the older they get. I'm down in Florida. I'm in Southwest Florida, which is the capital for retirement communities. There are hundreds of them here. And they're beautiful. I just drove through one yesterday taking a shortcut. I didn't realize that shortcut would take me like 15 minutes to drive through this community. It was thousands of acres, beautiful homes. I'd never seen it before. Then I got curious and I found out there were like 3,000 plus people living in this one community. When you talk to the people, they've worked hard. Most were small business people, by the way. And they like the weather here. They like the environment. They like the people. So one day they're going to wake up. If what you say is even half correct, and they're going to be in crisis. And think of all the other people who are not as fortunate as they to have an asset, possibly a paid-for asset, because our generation, once you get over the age of 50, you don't like debt. So you'd like to know that things are paid for. So if anything happens in an uncertain world, okay, you can survive. But what if you've been living on debt? One paycheck to the next, one credit card payment, paying another credit card, kiting your credit cards. Tell us about that story, please.
Yeah. So I want to, even if I can, back up a bit. I want people to understand that the reason that the pensions are unfunded is because of wrong-headed policy by these politicians. First of all, in the United States, pensions can't invest in the stock market for the most part. They have to invest in government bonds. Okay. And most people understand that if you invest in a bond, you want to get a return on it. It's safe money. You get all your principal back at the end, but you get a coupon that is maybe 3 or 5 or 6, or it used to be 7-8%. And you get that back every single year until your bond matures, at which point you get all of your money back. The problem is that in Europe, they have had negative interest rates since 2014. So for 8 years, they've had negative interest rates. In the United States, we all know we've had very, very low interest rates. Well, pensions invest in bonds, and they have to get 7-8% roughly in order to generate a yield adequate to service their liabilities to the pensioners, the people who draw on the pensions. So once you retire, they have to start paying you. And if they have been getting only 0.5% or 0 or negative for the last 8 years, how are they going to be managing their business? They can't. And this is the reason that the pensions are broke. So they've known about this. They've known that this problem was coming for a long time because the financial viability of these pensions has been eroding every year since they implemented these negative policies or close to zero policies in 2014. And so it is a completely government created problem. They basically robbed Peter to pay Paul. They propped up the banks, the big banks, by taking away, stealing from you. That's what's essentially happened. And I mean, history teaches us that when people are robbed, they ultimately fight back. Now, they may not fight back if they're just mugged on the street, but if millions of people have seen their pensions go away, they're likely going to rise up and say something about it, do something about it. And so this is why I think, you know, they're going to implement these universal basic income programs. I think they're crazy that they think that people are going to accept that they can live on $2,000 a month or whatever ultimately they're going to give them. I think it's going to be something like that, just given what they gave out from the CARES Act, you know, these COVID relief programs. So I think it's going to be something fairly nominal. One of the things they'll do too is they'll take bonds that are already out there that you already own and say, we're not defaulting, but we're going to change the terms of the bonds and we're going to make them perpetual bonds. And so we'll pay you a 2 or 3% rate going forward. And this will help some of these pensions a little bit, but ultimately they're all going to go away and it'll help people who've invested in them, but ultimately they won't get their principal back. And so I think what's happening is they're creating a situation that they know is going to be extremely volatile. And in order to offset that, they have to have the control grid in place. And that's why they are pushing so hard with all of these digital identifications. So, I mean, how much will people tolerate? I mean, Gary, I'm sure you've read the stories that the average American only has like $300 in savings, $400 in savings. And it's gotten worse in the last 20 years because they've been literally stealing from us and propping up their cronies. That's what's been happening. I don't know. Some people will clearly accept that, but I believe many millions will not accept being given $1,000 or $2,000 a month or $3,000 a month. And I mean, it pains me to say it, but I can't see how this country is going to survive this, because the states that are really in bad shape are California, New York, Illinois. They're the ones who've been pushing the COVID policies the worst, the hardest, and they're the ones who have the biggest problems. In 2018, California alone had a $60 or $80 billion unfunded public pension liability, just the state of California, to put that in context. And so these states are going to have major problems, but I think that they have more docile populaces. So they'll go along with it. But the populaces that want freedom, who care about the American dream, the ability to direct your own life and livelihood and the upbringing of your children, those people are not going to take it. And it's going to be, I think, a very dramatic outcome in the next 5 to 10 years.
I would agree with you. And thank you, Leslie, for doing the detailed discussion on that. I have several friends who are living on pensions. One is a New York police officer. Now, between his full health coverage, the best you can get, which is paid for, and his pension, he's bringing in around $124,000 a year. How did it get to that? Because his union was constantly negotiating with the city. The politicians in office wanted to get the school teachers' union votes, the municipal employees' votes, etc. So they kept acquiescing, irrespective of what was right. They had greater improvement every year in their, let's say, their retirement pension funds than the rise in inflation. And so now we have millions of individuals. Dallas, Texas is a good example. Dallas is a prosperous community. It's one of the most progressive communities in America. Very low unemployment. And if you're an educated person, you're going to get a job, and a good paying job. But they kept giving up the 8% in every year guaranteed. Now, once you guarantee someone that their pension is going to be 8% per year, plus add-ons depending upon inflation, and you think, okay, what's going to happen if there's a downturn in society, downturn in property taxes, downturn in other income that comes to this city or to the state? And no one seems to be paying attention now because of the bailout. that just happened last year, with trillions of dollars being given to all the states and the municipalities, a lot of states were able to use this in order to refinance and get up to equality in their pensions. Had this not happened, I think only one state in America, I think it was North Dakota or Montana, could actually say that they were okay with their pensions. They were not in deficit. But all the rest were, billions of dollars. So when you start looking at this, the capacity in the future to do this, how many bailouts can you keep giving? But in 2008, it was $800 billion in the TARP Act. That was started by Bush, but taken over by Henry Paulson and Barack Obama. And then Geithner came in and all the rest. And these were all a group of people who all knew each other. They were all from Wall Street, and they knew how Wall Street worked. So they all got bailed out. Now, the exact figure, I've seen figures that go from $3.6 trillion to $26 trillion that was given out. Insurance companies like AIG got them. All the banks got them. And I believe Citigroup got over $2.6 trillion. All of their debts, all of the mistakes made by all of their officers over a period of time were washed. That's legal money laundering, in my opinion.
Yes.
And then they were given new money at zero interest for all intents and purposes, 0.2%, that's zero. And then they went out there and they bought up their competition. They were flooded with money. But the average business, small business person you talk about being the number one employer in the United States with 2,000 employees, two-thirds of all employees being working for small businesses, they didn't get anything. And then the individual homeowners, they got nothing. Oh, they got evicted. That's what they got. And yet the President of the United States and Congress could have enacted emergency moratoriums to see that no one lost their home and all debt clocks stopped, because everyone who held a credit card who couldn't pay the full amount, you're suddenly bumped from 18% to 26%. Then if you're only partially able to pay that, it can go up to 50%. The payday loans would go up to 500 to 1,000%. That is worse than any Italian mobster film would charge you in. It's a loan shark. And yet no one interceded. No one stopped it. In fact, whole industries, including a member of Trump's cabinet, a man named Singer, they were in on this, meaning they own companies that look for debt because they could exploit the debt. They could try to get 100 cents on the dollar through different ways, and people were selling debt for pennies on the dollar. No one came in and said, this is all wrong. This is not the way our system is supposed to work. You don't reward all of these people and punish all these people, because when you, in effect, have a new debtor's prison, which was outlawed long ago, but now we have a new debtor's prison. And if you can't afford to get yourself out of debtor's prison, every day they keep charging you more money. True stories. We actually have debtor prisons in the United States. These are private entities supported by the Clintons and Obama. So everything in our society today, to me, should be reexamined to see whether it is honest, moral, or ethical. Does it make sense? Instead of having legions upon legions of bureaucrats and managers coming in, and these are the new royalty. These are the policymakers and opinion leaders. None of them are elected. They're all selected. And they're selected based upon their allegiances to who gives them that opportunity. So then we have core groups of power block people. And at the center of all of them are five companies: BlackRock, Vanguard, State Street, Berkshire Hathaway, and then there's a toss-up between the others to make that fifth one. They own, in every industry in the world, they own virtually the controlling interest and manage that money. It could be $11 trillion for one and $16 trillion for another and $7 trillion for another. Astronomical amounts of money they control. And they control the board of directors for any company. Like they control Google, Facebook, YouTube, which is Google, and Twitter. They control, they control Coca-Cola and Pepsi-Cola. You think you've got choices, you don't. behind the scenes, a group of people controls everything. We're talking about hundreds of thousands of corporations they control, yet you'll never see their name. They and also have the investment portfolios of the Rockefellers and the Rothschilds and the Goulds and the Swearingens and the Mellons and Morgans. So they put their money into these, but you'll never see their name. But they, whoever owns this, controlling the shares of stock, controls the board, controls the policies. And then they sent their tens of thousands of agents out. And then they go to the legislators, the ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council at the state level, and then the consultants and lobbyists to the federal level. And then they decide, we don't want this law and implement that law. So when you think, well, if it comes down to Joe Rogan being canceled, or not, what are some of the unknown factors? Well, who owns the site, the corporation? Is it one of these five? Who owns Moderna, one of the vaccines that Rogan was critical of? Well, that's BlackRock. So you start looking, they control everything.
And NIH.
Yeah, they control everyone and everything in a position of power. So if you don't bring all that into your purview to decide how does it fit, what is the likely outcome, they need to have us under their control. They make everything like 5G seem so not just important, but essential. Mm-hmm. They've turned a want into a need. Yeah. That's something that Edward Bernays, who was Floyd's nephew and the father of all propaganda, would have appreciated today. Virtually all the messages are on television are ones to control your behavior and your actions and your thoughts. So take us now, please, Leslie, into that area of a cashless society. And what would they do with gold and silver? The people have been hedging, and rightly so, because look at gold. Gold's up around more or less 2000, 1960, 2000, because of what's happening to the larger economy. And then also add into that, Leslie, because this is an area of your specialization, the equity market. There is no way in the world that any economist can tell me and be honest that the equity market should be 36,000 points. What's there to back it up? Don't tell me that you're justifying the value of your company at 60 times earnings, when if you went to sell it, you couldn't sell your company at 60 times earnings, and it's not making that money. So we're living with a financial illusion. It was F. Somerset Maugham, the great essayist, who said, never allow the public behind the scenes because it will cause them anger. It was the illusion that they loved. So we don't want to see behind the curtain of how corrupt everything is when it comes to maintaining power. Take us through this part now, please.
Yeah. There's so much. I mean, so much of what you just said, I want to add to. First of all, I feel like there's been a driving force towards this point for at least 20 years, since 9/11. And, you know, subsequent to 9/11, we had the Patriot Act within 45 days, written supposedly and passed within 45 days. And 2 weeks after that, the Model State Emergency Health Powers Act legislation was introduced, 2 weeks afterwards. And what was so incredible about that, truly remarkable about that model legislation, which has been ratified in whole or in part in, last I checked, 43 states across the United States, is that it accorded extraordinary powers to state health departments and governors in the event of a disease outbreak. How very convenient. So that happened in literally
hold one second, October. Please. One second.
So that Model State Emergency Health Powers Act legislation was incredibly convenient and actually facilitated what we've experienced in the last 2 years, which is this just massive usurpation of power by governors and health departments, state health departments. I mean, so you could have seen it coming a long time ago, and frankly, I did. And then you go forward to the PREP Act in 2005, another critical piece that allowed the Secretary of Health and Human Services to declare an emergency. And then that gave all of this immunity for liability. So protection from liability, financial and legal, for any products produced under the declaration of the emergency under the PREP Act. And then you move forward. You mentioned the suspension of habeas corpus in the National Defense Authorization Act. That was in 2012. And then they really took it further in 2013 and 2016. They actually repealed the Smith-Mundt Act, which banned the propagandizing of American citizens. And so they made it legal to propagandize Americans. And then they set up a program to do it. And then they funded the program in 2016. And so everything we've been experiencing, everything we've been seeing, I believe, had its seeds in 9/11, very interestingly, and facilitated what's happened in the last 2 years. So I just want to add that additional perspective to some of the things that you said. And then drilling down on the cashless society, you can't install a digital control grid without removing people's ability to trade and pay in cash, people's ability to be independent. If people are able to be independent from the system, it's not going to work. And so this is why for many years, it's not just been a little bit, it's been for several years, they've had different kinds of propaganda campaigns all over the world. In Australia, cash is for criminals. That's what they said. In India, they actually just did away with currency a couple of years ago with paper money. In Canada, Trudeau has signed legislation that authorizes him to cancel certain denominations, and he has. So what they've done is they've started eliminating the higher denominations, the thousands, the 500s, the hundreds, and they've started indoctrinating the public to believe that you're a criminal if you engage in cash. And then they start capping how much you can actually purchase, you know, what the size of purchases you can make in cash. This is happening all over the world as well. And then they go on and they, now we're seeing this other trend, which is that, so basically you shut down the ability for humans to be independent and to trade, you know, to buy and sell services in cash. You can only do it through their digital platforms. Simultaneous with this, the central banks are implementing their own, talking about, they've been putting out white papers for 3 years now at least, on central bank digital currencies. How very convenient. So what they want to do is launch their own digital currencies, similar to a crypto, and force everybody into that. And you won't be able to access that unless you have the digital ID. So, you know, that's a big part of it. And the Fed is now contemplating, I'm not sure if they've actually passed it. I think they might be doing it, but I'm not 100%. So don't hold me to that. But they want to start taking deposits from the public. The Fed has always been owned by a bunch of private banks. No one knows who. No one knows exactly who owns it or how it works. It's not, it doesn't report. It's not auditable by Congress. It doesn't report to anybody. It's totally independent. It's not federal and it's not a bank. But they dictate a huge amount of policy in the United States, obviously. And one of the things they want to do now is become a bank for the public. Well, won't that be convenient if everybody starts banking through the Fed instead of through, you know, a local savings and loan or a local, you know, any kind of a regional bank? So that's another component of it. And then you've got the merger between the banks, the corporations, and the Fed. And so what's happening is Facebook wanting to launch its own digital currency, other big tech doing the same thing. And so, you know, this is how they're going to implement this whole digital control grid, is by getting away of our freedom by using cash and working independently, and implementing a digital system that you can't access unless you're a good little boy or girl and you do what you're told and you get your shot every 6 months or year or 4 months or whatever it ends up being. But that's where it's all headed. And that's the whole cashless thing. And then I think the other big component of this, Gary, that can't go undiscussed, this is so important, and I know you are so knowledgeable about this already, but that is that the regulatory agencies, CDC, FDA, and NIH, are completely captured. 65% of FDA's drug approvers' salaries come from the pharmaceuticals' user fees that they pay directly to FDA. It's clear, it's somewhere between $2.5 and $3 billion. I think $2.6 billion in 2021 or 2022. And I can't emphasize enough how critical that regulatory capture is to this whole crisis that we've all been living under for the last 2 years. In addition to the fact that the hospitals, the universities, so all of academia, science, is all controlled by either the NIH, the giant foundations, private foundations that get to grow their money tax-free while the rest of us pay taxes, non-government, you know, NGOs are funding everything. So basically, they control our university system. They control our medical and research centers. They control the journals. Literally, the pharmaceutical industry pays a couple billion dollars every year to doctors. I don't remember that. I don't remember if that number is correct. I should look through my things. But they pay doctors specifically to act as spokespeople for them. So they're not conducting research or anything. They just bestow grants on them and honoraria, and they give them all these awards, and then they pay them tons of money to speak on their behalf. And the public is, you know, unwitting, doesn't understand that they're actually a paid spokesperson, not just a doctor acting independently. And then you have the journals, which are bought, and the journals are being paid money in the form of reprints. At The Lancet, I think it's JAMA and Lancet are about 40 to 50% of all of their revenue comes from preprints or reprints rather from the pharmaceutical industry. So this is where they get a study published in the journal, and then they pay money to have a nice glossy little article published and then shipped all over the world. The point is that everything is connected. The pharmaceutical industry owns a huge portion of the media, essentially through their ad revenue, $35 billion globally. The NIH, FDA, and CDC are all captured. NIH has garnered $2 billion in royalties on their own intellectual property in the last 20 years. I mean, it's just, we're talking huge sums of money. And so this is a critical component. If it weren't for this capture and the control of the media and the control of the journals, what we're going through wouldn't have happened. And I think it's another really important monetarily driven component to understand.
Very briefly, give us your insight into the corruption of science.
Oh, I don't think I even have to speak on that. You could just look at to what Professor John Ioannidis at Stanford has to say. I think he's the most published. He's an epidemiologist and the most published scientist alive. And he says he combined with Marcia Angel and Richard Horton. Angel used to be the editor of the New England Journal of Medicine, and Horton at The Lancet. And they all say that between 50 and 90% of research in science, research that's produced and peer reviewed and published in the journals can't be trusted, that it's probably fake or fraud. And it's because of everything I'm talking about. It's not just the regulatory agencies that have been captured, but science has been captured and the journals have been captured. And if they don't, you know, it's publish or perish, but you can't get published and you can't do your research unless you can get a grant. And who controls the purse strings? It's the giant foundations. NIH's budget that they give out grants is over $40 billion. It's the biggest source of funding in the world. And so you can't actually do research if you don't do research that is acceptable to those who hold the purse strings. And so it's something that I've railed against for a very, very long time, because science and our regulatory agencies are broken. They are corrupt to the core. There's a revolving door between the regulatory agencies and industry. The head of the CDC goes and heads up Merck vaccines globally. The head of FDA is now on the board of Pfizer. The R&D heads at Sanofi and other pharmaceutical industries come directly from NIH. I mean, these agencies are rife with conflicts of interest. There is no separation. And when the FDA is being paid in order to fast track all of these drugs and asking a court to block the release of the Pfizer COVID injection trial documentation for 75 years, it's pretty clear they're not working in the interests of the public. They're working in the interests of industry, and there's a problem. So, I mean, science is broken.
Leslie, thank you very much for being with us today. And if people would like to reach out to you, give us your email address, please.
Sure. They can reach me at info@healthfreedomdefense.org.
All the best to you. We look forward to another conversation.
Thank you so much, Gary. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you all for watching and listening to the Progressive Commentary Hour. Please share this information because a lot of people need to know it. I'm Gary Nall. Have a nice day.